This is Scientific Imagination, a podcast on the role and function of imagination in the natural sciences. My name is Sabine Winters, and this time I will go into conversation with Freya Blackman. Freya is an experimental particle physicist and lead scientist at DESI, Germany's largest accelerator center. For more information, visit scientificimagination.org. Freya Blackman is an experimental particle physicist and lead scientist at DESI, Germany's largest accelerator center. With a professorship in elementary particle physics at the University of Hamburg, she works on the compact muon solenoid detector at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, where she's also the lead physics communications officer. Her research interests include the search for signs of new physics, trying to experimentally answer questions like, how did the universe evolve? What are the smallest particles of matter, and are they really the smallest? What is the nature of space and time, and what really is mass? Really happy to welcome you here, Freya. Thank you so much for joining.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Could you please elaborate on the introduction that I just gave and on your current occupation?
So I'm an experimental particle physicist. So what that means is I try to do experiments with particles, the smallest constituents of matter that we know. And I try to do that in a very controlled way so I can really test things. So I can do like proper science, so hypothesis testing, have a prediction, then check if my prediction is correct and that kind of stuff. So I do that indeed using the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. I don't do that alone. Just a collaboration I work with, which is indeed called CMS, the Compact Muon Solenoid. It's named after the detector, which has a big solenoid in it. That's a coil magnet, for those of you who don't know. And so we named it after our magnet because we like our magnet. And and this is an international collaboration of people from, I think, something like 80 or 90 countries. There's about 3,500 scientists that work on it, of which I think about 1,000 are students, to give you some idea. It's very international. It's a very interesting kind of science because it's done in very large teams. That doesn't all mean we all do the same. The nice thing about these sort of particle collisions is that every collision is different and every collision has different particles being made. So people may be interested in different elementary particles and they just select the collisions that they need to do their study. Yeah.
Just quickly go back, the collisions. Could you elaborate on, for the listeners who aren't with physics, what a collision is?
Okay. The best way to explain what we do is, in some sense, it's a bit like a child trying to understand what is inside something. And the best way to do that is by taking it apart. Well, that's not the best way, but it's a way to do it. And this is more or less what we do as well with our collisions. So we smash elementary particles onto each other. And due to some very famous physics laws, including E equals mc squared, which probably most of you have heard of, you can convert the energy of those particles into many new particles. And those new particles that are being produced are random, but the randomness is described by quantum mechanics, specifically by something that we call quantum field theory. And there are many different particles that can be made. All of those come from, well, all of the ones that we've seen up to now come from particles that from a particle prediction model called the standard model. So this is an extremely successful model that can predict things up to like 10 digits behind in decimals. It's extremely good at making predictions, but we also know it can't be the whole picture. So it's a very good example of a theory in physics where there's a formula, you know the formula works really well, but you also already know from other physics considerations that the formula can't be the whole picture, and that there should be more. So what I do is I try to sort of break this formula by both studying the predictions and then seeing if the predictions are correct or not, but at the same time also seeing if by any chance there are other particles that happen to not be in our sort of in our list of known particles altogether.
Yes, because when you said observing the particles colliding, and then at least all of them we have seen, and then you started laughing a little bit. Is this because you have theories of not observed particles?
Well, there's many. This is actually this is the exact problem. So This is a field where there's one very established and well-working theory that we still know doesn't work in the big picture. So it only works in a certain context. An example that I sometimes give is it's a bit compared to, say, you know, gravity as described by Newton. And we all learned that in school, like you can shoot a bullet off a cliff or a tennis ball that you can hit and all that stuff, all those things fly. And then they get pulled by gravity. But that's also not the whole picture, because if you go to bigger masses or stars and things like that, you need a different description, right? Then you need general relativity. It is maybe not something you see every day, but this is really there. But so you need this extra bit to actually get it to work in a more general way. So this is exactly the problem we have. So we have something that works really well for one thing, but we already know that it doesn't work in a general way. We just don't know how to make it work yet. And there are tens of thousands of different ways to make it work in a more general way, but we don't know which one is right.
So I guess as a scientist, you really like solving puzzles.
Yeah. This is the work, right? The work is continuous problem solving. And that can get from many levels. And this can go from computer code, building detectors to see these particles that are not so easy to build. Also just the puzzle of when you get results, understanding them. In some sense for our field, also the interpersonal and organizational puzzle. Because working with so many people together also comes with its puzzles. Yeah.
I can imagine. And you are telling about solving puzzles. There seems to be a balance between solving puzzles and the experimental part, because you are an experimental in physics and new physics. Is this something different? Is this something different working towards a solution or doing experimental physics?
Well, these things are interconnected, right? So the way I look at this as an experimentalist, so maybe if you talk to a theoretical physicist, they will look at this very differently. But indeed, so I really believe in the empirical part of science. So I believe that physics is a science where you measure things to confirm a theory.
Yeah.
And then you test things and you learn more about nature by posing experiments or tests of that theory, which can teach you more about the theory or more about the topic that the theory describes, which in our case is the smallest building block of matter, right? So these are the smallest things that everything around us is made of. This, I think, is what an experimental scientist in general does, right? We try to understand things around us to more detail. We try to increase the knowledge of the world around us. So in my case, that means indeed looking for extra particles or understanding the particles that we already know better. Yeah.
And when coming to or working towards a solution or working on new models or theories, how would you describe the role of imagination?
I think there's a lot of imagination. There's a lot of creativity that is needed to have more ideas, both for how to expand it, because this is quite a difficult puzzle, right? So you have the challenge that you have something that needs to fit into a very particular shaped hole that we know very well. This is the thing, the part that we already understand, and that also that works well, can predict well, and we know exactly how it works up to a certain level. So we know this works. But at the same time, you then need to expand it and to make it consistent with all the other things. And when you do that, you might focus on, for example, adding extra particles that can also help you with other big questions that we have in science or particularly in physics, like things like the question that we know that just these particles that we already understand is only 5% of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. Everything else is not made of that. So there's something called dark matter, which we've called dark not because it's black, but because we don't know what it is. And there's already a lot more of that than there is of all the particles and all the atoms and everything that we know. So an obvious way to try to fix things is to add that. But then, of course, that can give you predictions maybe to what we can see in our collisions, because we make random particles, right? So that also means that these particles are really random. So, and we do not control what we make.
Yeah.
The only thing we control is the collision energy and how the particles smash into each other. So we know exactly how much energy is made. And then, of course, we have our formulas, which are called the standard model. So this is the main theory of particle physics. It's what this successful theory that we know works really well, but is incomplete. And that we can predict what we should see in these collisions.
Yeah. And does imagination then has to do with a process of reasoning, a process of creativity, of maybe conducting experiments in the head, or is it rather a visualization?
It's both, I would say. So there's, in general, I think that most physicists are relatively visually oriented. This also has to do with the fact that the math that we do is sometimes so complex that it is difficult really also for us to really imagine something with it. And that's much easier to do in a graphical way. So a very famous example of that are Feynman graphs. So this is a representation of an extremely complicated integral that you need to solve to predict these chances of different particles being produced in a collision. But the graphs are very easy to draw. So even though the mathematics behind it is really complex. So once you understand the mathematics, or actually the interesting thing is, even if you don't understand the mathematics, you can learn these graphs. And that helps you to really visualize much more what is happening in these collisions, which really helps you also to be more creative. So I think these two things are very intertwined. Of course, as we're really pushing the boundaries of knowledge, that means we need to, on a daily basis, then usually small ones, but in the big picture, regularly also on a larger context, we need to think of solutions that nobody has ever thought yet. So we really are forced to be creative there. Now, of course, you build on the knowledge you already have. So this is creativity in the sense that you use your prior knowledge to build and do something creative with that. But I think that's true in any form, also in art, to be honest. So this is
absolutely.
Yeah.
You work with very large teams, and I can imagine there are many disciplines involved in working towards theory or a solution. Is imagination and visualization in this sense also a glue to combine the different disciplines, or to find a mutual language? Because I can imagine that you speak different languages, quite literally, but also figuratively speaking.
I think so. I do think, like, you have to remember, so we use these visualization very often, particularly on the scientific level. We very often use it as shortcuts, right? So most of us, particularly the more senior people and the junior people in the process of learning this, also know the underlying math. So we use this, and this is actually something that can be very deceptive to the general public sometimes as well, because we tend to use these visual metaphors to communicate with each other and to the outside world, but we know that there is maths behind it, but maybe not everybody does. And what I sometimes see, particularly because I'm involved with communication, is that sometimes people take these things very literal and they say, why is this a dashed line? Does it mean anything? It's like, no, we just picked a dashed line because we agreed it would be a dashed line. There's nothing special there. So because we needed to see the difference between two lines. And so one of them we made dashed.
An example of a metaphor is there.
Like I said, the Feynman graphs are a good metaphor. Another good, very famous metaphor is things about the Higgs mechanism. So the fact that those all get different mass, and this is due to this field called the Brown-Dunlair-Higgs field, and this is all pretty hard maths and quite abstract. But what it means in practice, if you think about it, is that depending on which particle you deal with, when they move through this field, they have a different interaction with it. So they gain more mass or less mass. And a very nice way to explain that is, for example, if you have a famous and not so famous person at a party, then one of them will have a lot more people around them, and that will be the massive one then. So,
these metaphors are a way of storytelling for internal use within the research, but also to communicate it to the public.
Yeah.
But you really have to be an expert to understand, fully grasp the metaphor.
Or particularly know where the metaphor ends.
How would you say that, how would you explain the role of imagination in data interpretation, an example in modeling?
So modeling in some sense, so for us, I can tell you what the challenge is. So we have these particle collisions, we collect a lot of them. To give you some idea, we collect 40 million collisions per second. We can't even afford to save all of them. So most of them we throw away immediately. So we take a look at them, see if they're interesting or not. And if they're not interesting, we throw them away. Mm. And this is sort of like when you take 40 million selfies and you only keep a thousand because they're the good ones. So think of it like that. And maybe for some of us is how many selfies we need to take for a good but the point is that the imagination of deciding what to throw away, but also the imagination of how to simulate these collisions, because we need to compare these to predictions. And for that, we also do quite a lot of modeling and simulation, for which we use these very, very complex mathematical models to then really predict how a particle collision would look. So we need to also map hard maths to a signal in a detector. So there's quite a lot of work there, because if you would do everything, and to be honest, the physics of how these particles interact in these detectors is very well known. So this is mostly, say, late 19th century, early 20th century physics. So it's well understood physics. So most of it is ionization. So just charged particles interact and they do stuff. But the problem is it's so complex and there's so many particles that even with modern computers, we can't really do this on an atomic level. So we need to generalize and we sort of need to decide, well, if a particle flies through this block of iron, we know this much energy is deposited. Which is not really what's happening, right? The particle flies past every atom, and every atom it might do something or not do something. And so we generalize like that a lot, and those generalizations come with weaknesses,
yes,
and with shortcuts.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the creative work is in using your prior physics knowledge to design different shortcuts that might be just as fast or just as quick or just as easy, but are more realistic.
Talking about imagination, there's a different connotation, the feeling of wonderment. And when I ask people about imagination, they react differently when I ask them about the feeling of wonderment in that profession. It's something, there's a difference there, and I still don't know what it precisely is, but how would you describe the role of wonderment in physics?
I think in particularly my kind of physics, the feeling of wonderment is very important. So, and I would say that most people in my field are really driven by this. The feeling of wonderment, I think, is a very important aspect in physics in general, definitely in my field as well. If you talk to colleagues, this is typically the thing that they use as a motivation. So this is something that generates endorphins, right? This is what people like about the job. And the reason why they do the job is this feeling of wonderment, is the fact that you see something new every day, is the fact that you do things for the first time, is the fact that sometimes these problems are really very difficult and you can bang your head against the wall for years and then suddenly the wall is gone. And so there's that level of wonderment, also for the fact that you need to work with such complex machines to study such tiny things really creates a lot of excitement and wonderment. I think wonderment is extremely important. And wonderment is also something innately humane. And also, I think one of the things that when people visit the experiments at CERN, which when there's no COVID, you can do for free. The only thing that is there is a waiting list. But this wonderment translates. So people might not understand the problems that we're solving. They might not even find them interesting, which, to be honest, everybody's can have their own opinion about that. But they will get the wonderment as far as the work that we need to do to solve these really big questions, and which is really colossal and is in some sense extremely impressive as far as what humanity can achieve to solve these very basic questions.
Yeah. So fascination and wonderment functioning as a catalyst for
research. Yeah. Exactly. So one of the things that I found really interesting is a few years ago, before I was working at DAISY, I was a professor at the Free University in Brussels. And so I lived in Brussels for quite a while. So that means that I have friends who work for diplomatic organizations, because everybody does that when they live in Brussels. So I took some of these friends to CERN. So these are all people who work in international relations and in interpretation and dealing with EU policies, maybe, or some of them work for NATO. So these are very different profiles as what I have. And what they got from the CERN visitors indeed were, they got completely different things from it, like international collaboration, how we solve problems, how we manage to work together, the use of resources, but also indeed the fact that, which really inspired quite a lot of them, because they are, of course, also dealing with very big and very noble goals and trying to work together, which is the same thing as we do. And they also saw that we and them were running into the same problems. So it's not always easy. And you really need to keep the big goal in the back of your head sometimes to be able to work in maybe not so interesting or politically difficult or personally difficult conditions where you that where you need to be willing to compromise with other people to actually get to the final goal together. And I found it extremely interesting that that's what they got from this visit, besides the cool big machines, which they great picture.
Why is this something that really interested you, that they got this out of it?
Well, because I was aware that we were solving these problems. And of course, I was also aware that these other big international organizations also deal with these problems. But to really see them really immediately putting the finger on that, this is what we share, which I thought that was really very interesting. Yeah.
And speaking about imagination and wonderment, and that wonderment is like the driving force behind research, what sparks your imagination and your sense of wonderment in your work, maybe in life in general?
Well, I like to do new things. I like to see new things, and I like no day to be the same. So that's, for me, that's very important. And I'm privileged enough to have found a job where they will pay me to do that, which is fantastic. Yeah.
Yes. Was this also your biggest motivation to throughout your career? The sense of wonderment and doing different things?
Yeah. I would say that... I would say yes. The work is enjoyable because of the wonderment. So these things are connected. So the job I have is extremely competitive to get. There's not many people that, though there's many people that have the ambition to do my job, and probably also many people that have the capacity to do my job, but there's only very few positions. So it's highly competitive to get them. And there's definitely aspects of luck involved and being at the right place at the right time and all that stuff. But in general, I think the people that make it, this sense of wonderment is really what is driving it. And the fact that there are these unanswered questions that you more or less are guaranteed to get wonderment for the rest of your career is really nice. It would be very boring if all scientific questions were answered for a scientist. I'm not so sure scientists would be happy with that. Fortunately, the way science works, there's always something smaller or something more complex to study.
So, that puzzles you. Yeah.
Yeah. I like puzzles.
And what would be your absolute dream project to work on?
I think I already am working as far as I think in the big picture, I'm already doing my absolute dream project. Of course, there's things that I would prefer, and it would be fantastic to start thinking about better colliders and more energetic colliders and things like that. But I think what we have at the moment with the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is fantastic. It's really the achievement of many governments working together and committing to investing money, because this is not something that you cannot do in 5 years with one country. This is something that you need to commit for 40 years with at least 40 countries. And then you need to pull your money together, and then you can do this. So that already gives you some idea of how fantastic the project is that we can work on. Of course, we had to really defend these, and this is the process that we're doing at the moment for the next generation of colliders. So when you try to figure out something that is takes that long and so many people want to be able to use it, it's by definition a compromise, and it needs to be able to do many things. So I always say it's not the best chef's knife, it's a Swiss Army knife that does many things, because there's many things that want to be able to use it, many people that want to be able to use it, and it should provide something for everyone.
So in the bigger picture, being a scientist means taking, because a lot of people think when you are a scientist, especially during the COVID times, many scientists are popping up in talk shows everywhere, voicing their opinions. But being a scientist in the bigger picture is really being not self-centered, doing a lot of compromising, working together with big groups.
Well, yeah, the working together with big groups is something that is becoming more prevalent in most scientific disciplines, but indeed in my scientific discipline, this has been already quite common. So to give you some idea, even in the early 2000s, I was working in teams of 600-700 people, and which was unique at that time. There's very few places where you get to work with so many people together. And I really enjoy that part of the work. So I like working with different people. I don't always like working with different people, of course, but most of the time I do. And so I think that one of the things that is very important for people to grasp is that if you actually have a scientific approach, that indeed it's very external. So this is not about my opinion. This is about facts. And this is also what makes it very, very difficult for many scientists to go into the media during COVID times, particularly, I think, well, I didn't have to do that because it's not my field, fortunately, but the challenge of trying to explain that something is a fact and not an opinion is not always so easy in an arena where everything is about opinions and opinions being presented as facts.
Yes. Yes.
When I say I know how often the Higgs boson is made because I can calculate it, that really doesn't mean that's my opinion. That means I actually calculated and I've measured it.
Yeah.
And I saw that the number agreed with my calculation.
Yeah. Yes.
That's not an opinion.
Yes, that's a fact.
That's a fact.
Talking about maybe the image of science in general and you being a communications officer as well, and talking about dream projects and big teams working together, what do you hope to achieve for science in general in the next 10 years?
So we're really just at the start of the LHC program, which sounds a bit silly because we've already been running for 12 years. But so we're going to run until 2037 at least.
Mm-hmm.
So that's already a lot longer than 10 years. So 10 years from now, it will be 2032. So that will mean we will have installed new detectors and the LHC will have been upgraded. And that will have been a lot of work. So I hope that we succeed in that and that our new detectors will be ready in time. And at the same time, we will probably need to have made a decision as far as thinking about if we want a future collider and what kind of future collider we want.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to build something that will follow up the LHC, because if we run until, say, 2037, building an accelerator takes 10 years as well. So you need to start if you want to have one, but you're done with the previous one. And so that's sort of on the organizational side. On the physics side, of course, the idea is to take a lot of data and then really search in the data for new particles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to really see if the standard model we have, if it's the whole picture.
The whole picture.
If we can already find deviations that we know should be there or not. So this is the challenge and this is also one of the reasons why we do things in our field in a certain way. People might have strong opinions about what their private favorite of one of these many expansions of the standard model is, but that should not blur your objectivity, right? So the goal is to see if there is something new.
Yes.
And if there is something new, what it is. Now, the problem is indeed you can approach that through as many different methods as there are physicists. So what I will do in the coming 10 years is I will use the tools that I know very well, which is one quark, which I have been studying since I started doing physics in the early 2000s, called the top quark. It's the heaviest one of the six quarks. And I will use that to see if there's new particles being produced together with that. And of course, I hope that my gamble is the right one, but it's just as good a gamble as people who use a different particle to see if there's something. There's of course motivations to say, well, it's a heavy particle, so it might be sensitive to other heavy particles, but these are relatively subjective. So it's a gamble. People will use my detector that I help building as well for what they are doing. So it will always, even if I made the right gamble, the person next to me made the wrong gamble, we still sort of share the glory, because in the end, we are really working together in other aspects, particularly in the data taking and in the interpretation of the data and making sure that we have all the tools, those we share. So in that sense, it will still be shared glory. And let's hope there will be some new particles. Like I said, there's very good arguments to know that the standard model isn't the full picture. The question is whether an accelerator is powerful enough to see something new.
How exciting is that?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. And also, you're always standing on the shoulders of giants, right?
Of course. It's a classic. And it's been a classic for 400 years. And we'll continue to be a classic.
We only really scratched the surface of your research of science in general. And I even didn't dare to ask about quarks. Maybe we should share to our listeners and myself as well. Where can we follow you online to dive into your research?
So I'm quite active on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is Freya Blackman, which is just my first name and last name. And you're definitely welcome to follow me there. I try to communicate at a relatively low level there. It is somewhat technical, but I do answer questions as well. The target audience of my tweets is not fellow scientists, so.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being on this podcast. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. And
all the best.
It was a pleasure. Research.
Thank you.
For more information, visit scientificimagination.org. Thank you for listening. In the next episode, I will go into conversation with space philosopher Frank White about the books that he wrote, about the role of imagination in space philosophy, and the overview effect.